Everyone will be world famous for 15 minutes. Thus spoke Andy Warhol, and that statement has particular resonance for Daryl D. Miller. A Cincinnati native and an alum of SCPA and CCM, he had a career performing throughout the world, and then in 1990, he shifted gears and earned a law degree from Georgetown University. Now one of the country's foremost entertainment lawyers based in Los Angeles, his client list includes Angela Bassett, Roscoe, Rocky Carroll, and Chris Bridges, otherwise known as Ludacris. Dunham Books has just published his book, The 16th Minute of Fame, An Insider's Guide for Maintaining Success Beyond 15 Minutes of Fame. And Daryl is here in our studio. Welcome back to Cincinnati.
Thank you for having me.
You talk a lot about SCPA's role in shaping your career. Tell us about that.
SCPA was really where the first seeds were planted that I think expanded my brains beyond the halls of Cincinnati. 98% of my family is still right here, born and raised, and unfortunately die here. And SCPA really opened my mind to just other opportunities, travel, other career possibilities, and planted a lot of seeds that turned out to be flowers in my life.
And it was your best friend who got you there, wasn't it?
Yes, my friend Rocky Carroll, or as we call him, Roscoe, who is now professionally known as Rocky Carroll. But Rocky had gone the year before me and was telling me about the school. I was a drummer at the time and asked me to audition. I auditioned for the school and was admitted the following year as a drummer at SCPA.
And you talk a lot, too, about timing and about being willing to take risks. And you hadn't even considered going to college, had you?
Not at all. You know, I grew up in a very kind of middle-class, blue-collar neighborhood. And for the most part, because there's so many corporate headquarters and good-paying union jobs that were all here around the time that I was growing up, it was generally acceptable that you could graduate from school and get a good job and work for 30 years and get your retirement. So I didn't have a big family. I didn't have anything that would push me beyond that immediate opportunity. And everyone was kind of happy doing that. And I thought that was my fate.
So how did you end up at CCM?
CCM, I have to say, and it's in the book also, I attribute really a counseling teacher at SCPA by the name of Gwen Fields. And I was literally ready to graduate, a fifth in my class, and had worked really hard, had a wonderful career performing at SCPA, ready to just go off. And Ms. Fields pulled me to the side and said, hey, have you ever thought about college? In particular, thought about CCM right up the hill, which is a world-renowned conservatory right here in your backyard. Why don't you think about it? You seem to enjoy this artistic stuff. And she really put me on the path of understanding what that process was, that I could apply, that I had grades that would qualify me, and I just had to go through the audition process. So SCPA and Ms. Gwen Fields was really instrumental in opening the door again to something that I just didn't even know was an opportunity.
You were a drummer, but you ended up in the performing arts.
Yes.
So you went into musical theater.
Yes. A funny story is a drummer. I went into the school as a drummer, but in the SCPA days that I was there, they made you take one class from every other discipline, ballet and fine arts and everything. And so I had to take choir, even as a drummer. And I remember being in the choir and the exam was singing My Country Tis of Thee. And all the instrumentalists and band members sang like little mouse, you know, My Country Tis of Thee. And it came my turn, and I had a really loud, My Country Tis of Thee. And the professor stood up from the piano and dragged me around to a couple of other music directors. And the next day, I was in the top choir of the school, and they trained me. And then for the rest of my life, I ended up being a singer.
How many minutes of fame did you snag at CCM?
Well, you know, CCM, I got my roles on stage. I got my opportunity to really shine. And, you know, we had a really dynamic group of people. At that time, Kevin McCollum, who's a big Broadway producer, was there when I was there. Rufus Bonds, who's been the Lion King, Mustafa for many years, has been there. Donald Lawrence, who's a Grammy Award-winning recording artist, is there. We had a number of people there doing really quite well, and I got my 15 minutes there at CCM also.
Well, what prompted your decision to go to law school?
For me, I kind of had an epiphany in connection with one of the tours that I was involved in. I traveled the world after college and before law school for a couple of years. The last tour I did took me all through India and in Sri Lanka and just kind of around the world and around the Middle East. And I really had an epiphany just being blown away that a young African-American kid who really thought he would be standing working on a Ford line was standing in India on the shores performing for royalty around the world. And I initially went to law school thinking I would make enough money and build enough savvy to produce international productions for the rest of my life, because I found that a lot of lawyers were behind the scenes of new deals, structuring the deals and putting them together. And I wanted to get a degree and perhaps be a more creative lawyer and to do something that I wanted to do.
So when you began your practice, you focused on entertainment law?
No, actually, I always desire to apply the law to entertainment. But you quickly learn once you enter into law school, all law is the same, particularly the first year. You're pretty much in trying to survive. And then you get in, and there's really no entertainment track within law school, and you kind of learn general law. I came out at that time in 90 after an 87 market crash, and there were still very few jobs. So I took a job. I actually got a few offers, but the job I took was as a civil litigator. I litigated, and my creative background helped me quite a bit in the courtroom and depositions. I was able to say my name and standing on my feet as well as be a good writer. So at the end of the day, I came out as a litigator, did a little bit of corporate finance work, and I only started entertainment probably after I had 5 or 6 years under my belt of just being a good lawyer first.
And you racked up a quite impressive client list, some of the best known names in the entertainment business. That was acquired over a period of years.
Absolutely. That's a blessing and a lot of hard work and, and a lot of seeds planted. I have always had the philosophy that if a client ever gives me the opportunity, I'm going to do everything within my power to earn that opportunity and to maintain that relationship. So I've worked to not just look at an artist or a deal as a one-off, but look at an artist and a deal as a potential career. And so for over the last 23 years that I've been in Los Angeles, I've worked very diligently to provide a high quality of service and to kind of maintain long-term relationships with many of the people that open the door. So over the years, if you get a couple every year, you end up with a pretty decent client list.
And now you're managing partner in your firm.
Yes. I don't know if that's a blessing or a curse, but I am.
Your book is focused on those specifically in the entertainment field, but you stress a universal mantra, and that is diversify, diversify.
That really is, I think, the most important message for me is that I tell it in the backdrop of what I know, which is entertainment. But the real, I think, commercial appeal, if I'm successful, will be that the message is really transferable across a lot of platforms. When I thought about it, I'll tell you a quick example, is the lottery winner. I talk about entertainment people and how their life cycles are very short and they don't think about it after the life cycle and what do? And they work all their lives to get a role on TV or get an opportunity to be on a football field or a team, and then it's all blown. And it's sort of like the other side of that is a lottery winner who spends 10, 20 years trying to win the lotto. You win $200 million, and statistically, they say 98% of them are worse off or broke within years after they've won all that money, when you would think the opposite. They've been set up, they have a trust, and they'd be kicking off money. So I think the idea of the 16th minute of fame, really about finding your way to understand that whatever success you have right now will come to an end, and you have to figure out how to sustain it beyond that end. And don't think about it in the 15th minute, because it's way too late to be thinking about sustaining it. You got to think in the first and the second minute so you make better decisions along the way.
You said you were back at CCM earlier today, and it was quite revealing to be back at your old haunt. You couldn't find your way around.
And I guess in the years that I've been gone, there's been so much construction, so much reconfiguration of the roads. I couldn't even park in the garage. I couldn't find the garage, actually. So that was an eye-opener.
The students to whom you spoke, how well prepared are they to face the kind of challenges they're going to face?
They appeared, on one hand, to be much more prepared than us, because the school today actually finds a way to do showcases in the major cities and create access for them with casting directors and directors and producers that might give them an opportunity. We didn't have anything like that. We kind of worked in a bubble, exceeded in a bubble, but kind of once we walked out the doors, we were on our own. So that's a really good connection. The other side of the coin, though, is when you look at the preparation that creative people get on the business side, I still don't think there's enough. Because just in asking questions and trying to better understand how prepared young people are to really face the business issues of entertainment, I couldn't get a sense that there was a lot more progress made than when we were there. But it's sort of like you get in, you're really, really talented, and then you find out talent sometimes may not be enough, because it's really about understanding how to build relationships, how to understand how to monetize your brand, understanding now today you got to understand social media. You got to understand all these other things that come and work hand in hand with just having a great talent. So I still think that there's room for improvement in those areas for all institutions, because that's just something that has to be learned and managed more carefully.
Another aspect that you stress is the importance of surrounding yourself with loyal and honest people. And that sounds so obvious, but obviously that's not the case.
And I'll tell you, I spend my day and basically cleaning up. I'm a very high paid babysitter for people who often believe that they are above accountability, who are often insulated from the most common sense advice, and who basically doesn't have a person often in the camp that will say no. And if you are like that in a world where no one says no, all of a sudden values are suspended when convenient, and you don't have someone who can pull your coat tail and say, hey, remember, keep the feet on the ground and this is where you go, it can be very difficult with all the money and fame and prestige and attention that the first generation money people will get.
Is that the major challenge you think that faces most of your clients?
I think it faces anyone with sudden wealth, first generational wealth, which today more wealth is built than acquired. It has, in the past, more wealth was acquired by trust and built. And so as we have more and more people actually building wealth out of the tech industry or entertainment industry or the sports industry or just business industry and just good investing, we need to, I think, spend more time making sure that they're prepared to manage that wealth and that they have an understanding and that they begin the preparation before it's time to count on that wealth.
Well, I think you've more than tripled your fame minutes. Thank you so much for joining me. My guest is entertainment lawyer Daryl D. Miller. He's the author of The 16th Minute of Fame, published by Dunham Books. You can find out more by going to our website, wvxu.org. For Around Cincinnati, I'm Ann Arenstein.